Kick-Ass Vets, sharing tips to help empower you to take control of your career. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. I'm Anne, as always, with Kick-Ass Vets, and today we are very lucky to have Dr. Joe with us to talk about compassion fatigue, burnout, and mental health issues in the veterinary world, in the vet industry, and Joe recently has gone through a bit of an experience. So do you want to first start by telling us just a little bit about your vet background and then kind of what happened in the past month that led to you creating the Vet Positivity Facebook group, which is amazing and is taking off a house on fire, which is great.
That was a surprise, that's for sure.
It's great.
I thought I might have 50 people join up, and now it's nearly 1,700, which is slightly scary. But it's good that it's obviously needed, I guess.
Yeah, for
people
sure.
like it, I hope.
Well, they wouldn't be there if they didn't like it.
Well, exactly. Well, they might be ignoring it, I just don't know. Background-wise. So I've been dibbing and dabbing in the vet industry for probably about 7 years. Started off as a vet nurse, went through vet school, became a vet, been out as a vet for only about 3 years, not even that quite yet. Started off with an internship off the bat in emergency and critical care, a bit atypical, then worked in research for about a year, and then I decided to take on locuming full-time. I was still locuming during the research year as a part-time thing, just to keep my foot in the sort of clinical door. And yeah, it's been an interesting run in 3 years.
And what has happened with you in the past kind of couple months that has led to this whole vet positivity and trying to talk about the mental health side of things?
Yeah, so I always thought myself as quite resilient, like, these problems don't affect me, I'm tougher than that.
Don't we all feel that?
I know, right? And I've had like small burnouts in the past, but like just overwork sort of thing, like just a bit sick and tired of it. Take a few weeks off, you get better and you're fine. The last few months though, I didn't quite realise what burnout really meant, and this was a complete utter hit the bottom, bounce off the bottom just to hit it again burnout, and resulted in like being diagnosed as a clinically depressed person. I had an MRI for tension migraines, and my doctor thought I was maybe having an aneurysm.
Oh, God.
Things like that.
When did it all start? Like, when did it come to a head that you realized there's a problem?
It's a bit hard to say, but I realized everything went really pear-shaped effectively when I nearly destroyed my life around me outside of work.
Fair enough.
So yeah, you don't realize that when you're sort of depressed and burnt out and things like that, that you actually do hurt the people around you. You think you're hurting yourself, you think you're not hurting yourself that much until you realize that actually you caused a lot of damage outside of your own personal bubble.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized that things weren't really pear-shaped, when effectively I got told, you're freaking depressed, you have to do something about it, get on top of your life.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
Well, that's good. At least you had someone that cared about you enough to say that and to be like, get your shit together.
No, it's definitely true. It was definitely a wake-up call. Can't say things have been fixed properly since, but it's one of these things that effectively at the end of the day, you don't get fixed overnight.
Yeah.
As much as you think you do. The first sort of like session you may have with a psychiatrist, or the first time you realise, you think, oh, okay, yeah, I'll just do these few things and I'll be fixed. But you're not. You realise that once you've hit that sort of low point, you sort of simmer along the bottom for a while, you slowly get better. It's very easy to hit the bottom again without knowing it, but it's actually an ongoing thing that you have to look after your mental health and your physical health. And the vet positivity came up because I just had this session with a psychiatrist, and he was like, you also need to sort of like, you need to change your mental attitude to see the positive in things, not just the negative. We are predisposed to seeing the negative in things. It's an evolutionary thing, like a flight and flight sort of survival response. And I remember being on Facebook, and there's all these great groups, like Not One More Vet, or I can't remember the other one's called, like Veteran Confessionals, something like that. And they're rant groups, which serve a good purpose. You do need to rant sometimes to get things off your chest, but nothing was positive. And I like search for positive groups, nothing at all. I thought, well, this is my chance to sort of like create something where you can get some positive exposure, and hopefully that helps.
Yeah. Do you feel that creating something to help other people is part of that healing process?
It's definitely. So I wouldn't say, like, And no, I'm not an expert. Like, I'm not a psychiatrist, a sociologist, whatever they're called. Like, but it helps knowing that you can potentially stop someone going through the same thing.
Yeah.
Or hopefully making them realise that there's a problem and that they can fix themselves.
Yeah.
Like, we can all fix ourselves at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Unless you're some narcissist. But that's a completely different sort of, like, kettle of fish, to be honest.
Yeah.
And, yeah, knowing that you can help people does make a difference. It gives you a bit more hope and scope.
Mm-hmm. I feel that starting Kick-Ass Vets, one of the reasons I started it was because I was just so frustrated over and over, and my husband was like, you need to stop just talking about, like, you need to stop ranting. Like, if you're gonna just do something about it,
yeah,
just do anything, because you're just doing the same thing and being angry and ranting and complaining. And, like, poor Eric, I just terrible to him in terms of just constantly talking about work, constantly complaining. And it takes a huge, huge toll on your relationship and those around you. So I started Kick-Ass Vets for that reason, to try to help make a difference for other people. And, like, to this day, every time I get an email from someone being like, I used your information and got a raise, or I used your information and I changed my job and now I'm happier, I literally start to cry, because it feels so good to help people. And it's the same, like, morbidity and mortality rounds. When you make a medical mistake, one of the most cathartic things that you can do is teach other people about it so that you don't make the same mistake again. So it's the same thing with the mental health. If you can teach someone else and share that experience and feel that you're making a difference in someone else's life, that is one of the most cathartic things that you can do. And, like, the vet positivity thing, like, it's amazing. So many people are jumping on, and the University of Sydney...
Sydney Uni has caught on, and they're sort of interested in some stuff as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're doing this blog now.
Yeah.
I've had someone else talk to me about doing podcasts as well. So it's obviously something out there that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
And it's not that either of us are that special for creating this. It's just...
Not at all.
We just... I don't know. We're in a position and figured, why not do it? Like, if not us, who?
Yeah.
If not now, why?
Exactly. You just get to the point where you're like, I have to do something. And if I don't do something, I'm going to explode.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, definitely. So once you had this person in your life say, you need to get your shit together, you're depressed, go fix yourself, what was your process to get to the point where you went to see someone, to talk to someone? Because that's a hard thing to do for a lot of us. Like you said, we're type A. We feel that we should be tougher than that. We feel like it's a failure if we need help.
There's a stigma as well. Like, people think that you only go to a psychiatrist if you're completely nutter or off your rocker. Like, it's not true. They really do help. And
so just
need to get your head around that as well.
How did you end up going down that path? How did you kind of get to that stage? What's the process?
Months of denialism. And being told again and again and again, saying I'm doing something about it, but not actually doing something about it, until things blew up properly.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, this is not a joke anymore. Not that I ever thought it was a joke in the first place, but it's time to take this really seriously. And I wouldn't say it's courage to bite the bullet and do it. It's more desperation.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if people can get there without the desperation part.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I do this vet positivity thing, is that if you catch someone before they hit the rock bottom, then they can hopefully fix themselves and everything before too much damage is done. And that's the thing. Like, I had to create a lot of damage before I actually got my head around the fact that I needed to do something about it.
And you sent me a great questionnaire from the Queensland Health that your GP sent you, practicing.
Yeah.
And I was reading through and I was like, yeah, these are some questions that I really don't want to be asking myself. There's some uncomfortable questions in there, but you said that was really helpful, and that, so you went to your GP first?
Yeah, I went to my GP first, not because I really wanted to talk to a GP, but when I initially signed up to the psychiatrist, he said, if you go and get a mental health note from your general practitioner, you get 10 sessions covered by Medicare, which is
good to know.
Yeah, which is Australia's health insurance program, I'm not sure what to call it.
Yeah.
But to do that, you have to sit this questionnaire.
Yeah.
It's called the KESA 10 questionnaire. It's 10 questions, maximum score of 50, minimum score of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Higher the score, the more likely it is for you to have some sort of mental problem.
Yeah.
So I scored 36 out of 50,
yeah,
which is high. And that was correlated with having a significant psychological disorder, such as depression. I never had suicidal tendencies, but some people have that, and things like that. Yeah. And that was a wake-up call. It was like, okay, I know it's just a test, but at the same time,
I am actually probably
clinically depressed, and I never thought I'd be a person that would be depressed.
Yeah, I didn't even... I started reading through, and I was like, I'm not putting numbers down for this. I'm not ready for that.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely something that is eye-opening. So that, obviously, your score got you into the...
It got me into the program, yeah.
What tips have you learned from the psychiatrist? Like, what did they have you do? What did they suggest?
It's weird going to a psychiatrist if you've never been to one. They have this amazing ability to sort of make you watch a film of your own life.
Oh, God.
If that makes sense.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, it kind of is. But it's very useful. They sort of like ask you questions, and the way they phrase it, it makes you look back on what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see actually how bad things were from someone else's perspective, and if you were like a bystander on your own life.
Yeah.
And that's a real wake-up call when you realise, oh my God, I was doing that stuff. Like, I was saying those things. I was reacting that way. That's not me.
Yeah.
It is not me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing. People which are depressed or emotionally exhausted, whatever the words you want to use for it, they often aren't true representations of themselves, and that's what the psychiatrists make you realise.
Yeah.
And then after that, once you've realised where you stand, they give you tips to start fixing things.
Yeah.
And it's not like crash diet where you just change everything overnight. It's a gradual thing. So every time I go back, it gives me more homework.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I didn't know how to do more stuff. But like, even just simple things, like when you're having a bad thought, one simple thing you can do is just say, stop that thought. Say it out loud. It engages several parts of your brain, and you sort of like come back to reality, and you stop ruminating on these bad thoughts. Because when you start ruminating these bad thoughts, you can sit there for a long time and actually build up that depression.
I have that problem. I just like loop and loop and loop and loop and loop.
Yeah.
And I have a really, really hard time stopping that train of thought. So he recommends just saying out loud,
stop that thought.
I'm going to try that.
And other things were, when I was at my worst, I'd find it really hard to get out of bed on my days off. Even my days I had to work, I was like, you'd lie there for an eternity and nearly end up being late and things like that. Or you go to bed and you start thinking about things, then you can't sleep. Lack of sleep makes things worse.
Yes.
But there's no distractions at that point. You're there by yourself and your thoughts.
Yeah.
And you ruminate again on these thoughts.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you've actually made the problem bigger than it actually is. The problem is only as bad as it actually is in real life, but you make it bigger by thinking about it too much.
Yeah.
So the trick was, get out of bed as soon as you wake up. If I can't get to sleep, I have to get up, I get out of bed, I go and do something, whether it's dull or interesting.
Yeah.
Something just to stop that process.
Yeah.
And it's obviously worse now. Well, it was worse, it's better now, and it'll be better in the future. It's not necessarily something you have to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But like I said, you don't go from being rock bottom to completely fine again. It's a slow, gradual curve upwards.
Yeah.
And until you're at the top there, you need to keep playing along the game.
I cannot fall asleep without listening to something, because my thoughts otherwise will loop. I literally cannot be okay. I'm not okay in my own head. I'm not. And I know it's a huge problem, and like Eric tells me all the time, like, you need to get okay in your own head. And it's, I have to listen. I listen to Harry Potter, Stephen Fry, reading Harry Potter audiobooks. I've listened to the same audiobook every single night for the past like years.
Fair enough.
And I was getting to a point where I was okay. So my goal is to try to like get off the Harry Potter crack. But it's hard, because if I'm lying there, I start to think about all of these things, some work related, some not work related, and it's so difficult to stop that process. And then it's like 2 a.m. You're like, well, I don't want to get up and go do something. So it's...
And that's the trap we fall in. Like, you don't want to get up because you're scared if you get up, it'll make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to get worse than it actually is, to be honest. at that point in time, you need to get up and distract your brain.
Yeah.
Your brain still needs to do something. It can't go from, like, thinking 100% to zero.
Yeah.
You need to sort of, like, wind down the system, and that's why doing things like reading a book helps. Because your brain's doing something, but it's been taken off those thoughts, and it sort of helps it wind down a bit. There's some apps out there as well that have sort of sleeping aids where effectively they make you do breathing exercises.
Do you find things like that? Have you used any of those?
I've used a few of them. They do work to a certain degree because the way they're designed is that they make you count breaths and things like that, so your brain is still working.
Yeah.
But you're not thinking about, oh my God, tomorrow I have to go in and there'll be 50,000 clients waiting in the car park angry because there's only one bet on or something like that.
Yeah.
So those do help. And the other thing that, to be honest, when you first told me, I was like, this is not for me, but it's mindfulness, meditation sort of exercises. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was a bit of hippie nonsense, to be honest. And I thought, oh, okay. But I thought, I'll just try it. I can't say I haven't tried it.
Yeah.
And I do it every morning now,
mm-hmm.
without fault.
How long? Meditation is something that people have told me over and over and over again that I need to do because I'm crazy and need to calm down and calm down a bit. And I would love to be able to do it, but I don't think I've ever really given it a fair go, to be perfectly honest. Like, if I'm being honest, I don't think I've ever actually given it a fair go. I've tried to, like, sit there and calm down, and sometimes I'll go down to the water and I'll just watch the waves and that kind of stuff. But I find it really difficult because then I just end up sitting there looping on my thoughts.
And this is where I think most people think that meditation is sort of sitting cross-legged and you sort of, like, close your eyes and wait for yourself to levitate off the ground.
Yes, that is what I think.
Yeah, and that's why I thought as well at the beginning. I was like, I can't just sit there with my eyes closed and not think about anything.
Yeah.
But there's lots of aids out there for mindfulness meditation,
mm-hmm.
and they're making your brain work at the same time, but you're not thinking. Now that sounds weird. So, like, well, some of the exercises are like you do breathing patterns and you close your eyes, and then you have this aid in the background that says, okay, now it's time to concentrate on the sounds and start concentrating on different sounds you hear in the environment. So at the moment, like, concentrate on the car sound, and when that in a few minutes time, concentrate on the bird chirping.
Okay.
And that sort of focuses your brain on something.
Yeah.
It does help you stop thinking,
mm-hmm.
but the trick is that once you start doing that, you have to then realize when thoughts are coming into your mind and then being able to snap out of those thoughts and concentrating back on whatever sounds or breathing or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So you're never not going to have thoughts going through your head, but it's being able to realize when those thoughts are happening.
Yeah.
And then stopping those thoughts and concentrating on something else. So if anything, is training your brain to realize when toxic thoughts are coming through your head and then being able to detach yourself from those.
That would be lovely.
It takes a while.
I'll get the information about what some of those apps are, and I'll put them in the blog version so that people can link to them. Are there any other things that they've suggested that have been helpful?
Take time off.
Yeah.
Jokes apart, need to detach yourself from whatever's causing the anger. Keep up the exercise, keep up the good nutrition. And that was the thing, when I was at my worst, I wasn't exercising because I couldn't justify the time. And because I wasn't sleeping properly, I was like, well, I need to lie in now because I haven't slept. I spent 4 hours staring at the ceiling.
Yeah.
And this is an inherent problem in the vet world. As you go into, at least for me, an emergency clinic, and for you as well, you don't see fruit platters. You see bags of chips and, God knows what.
The job where I am now, they don't have cookies. They don't have crap. They have bowls of fruit.
That's a good idea.
It is literally, if you can talk to your boss and just the food that they provide, like, providing food isn't so much a thing in North America, but in Australia, every clinic that you work for, I don't know if they legally have to do it or if Australians are just super duper nice.
The feeders.
But they always have food, and like they usually have like bread and noodles and stuff, but most clinics I find will stock like biscuits and cookies and crap or like jars of lollies. But
something you can sort of shove in your face quickly.
And the place where I work has like the soup and stuff, but they have no easily accessible grabby junk food, and they have pears and bananas and apples.
And that's the best thing. It's still food you can shove in your face, but exactly. The type of sugar in it, it's a sustained release sort of energy, not like the Snickers bar, which is like you get this sort of spike of sugar and then you crash again 5 minutes later, so you shove another Mars bar on your face.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, now I need the energy drink because I'm on my lull.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you're some sort of like chemical, like toxic waste of a person walking around.
Yeah, and
that doesn't help.
It's going to be more expensive to the clinic, obviously, to buy fresh fruit, but like,
but think how much money you save.
So good for your employees, especially if you have overnights. I think like it's amazing. It's one of them. There's lots of reasons I like my one job, but that's one of the things that they do, which I think is, I've never seen that before.
No, everywhere I've been, it's always been junk food.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, it costs the clinic, I don't know, a couple grand more each year. But if it saves one employee taking 2 weeks of sick leave,
true,
that you've made more money back.
Yeah.
Than you've spent.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something clinics need to understand, especially the corporates, is that they're so busy concentrating on maximizing profits for shareholders,
mm-hmm.
that in reality they're actually costing themselves money by at the cost of the employee.
Yeah.
Like if you treat your employees properly, even like feeding them properly, or just even like giving them coping mechanisms, making them work a bit less,
yeah.
decreasing any kind of stress they can, they're actually going to save more money probably in the long run.
Oh, hugely. And just like dissatisfied clients. I'm doing a blog that I think it's coming out this Friday, I think. It's when you value your staff and when you focus on like keeping staff happy, that's good for business. Because you have one disgruntled employee, they're going to go and they're going to complain to the other employees. Then the other employees are going to be like, oh yeah, that person isn't blah, blah, blah. Oh yeah, we are understaffed. Oh yeah, there are too many like consults per hour. And then that level of dissatisfaction is going to spread. The clients can feel it. Like, clients aren't stupid. When they walk in the door and everybody's upset and everybody's like running around and no one has a smile on their face, they can feel that. They don't want to bring their animals to people that are unhappy. You lose good clients when your staff are unhappy, and then that causes high staff turnover. High staff turnover is incredibly expensive to clinics. It is good for business to keep your employees happy and to keep your employees long term. And the way to do that is by valuing them and having, you know, good mechanisms for them to cope, making sure that you're checking in, making sure that you're enforcing professional development. I think one mistake that a lot of clinics do, even clinics that are really proactive about offering CE, there's very few clinics that enforce continued CE. And I think that's something, I don't know, just from my brain, it's just my opinion, but I think if clinics enforce CE and said, no, you have to do so much CE every year, and when you do that CE, you're going to bring it back to the clinic, we're going to have a paid dinner where we're going to, you know, get dinner for everyone, and you're going to present that, and you're going to teach, and you're enforcing that continued education within your clinic, then you're making the vets focus on that, and you're showing them that you care. And then especially when they do that CE and bring it back to your clinic, you actually support them when they want to do the CE,
yeah, exactly.
Which is a huge problem.
And you need to make sure that they do the CE they want to do as well, because I've been to clinics where it's like, well, we don't see the benefit in you doing this course, why don't you go and do this one instead? And it's actually something you don't really care about.
Yeah, no, definitely something like trying to promote what people like. But I find a lot of clinics, they don't enforce it, or their staff are so burnt out and are so on the edge that you only have so much emotional energy. If you're already burnt out, you don't give a shit about doing CE.
No, you just want to go home and you want to go on holiday.
The last thing you want to do when you're burnt out is come home and then do more CE. Like, I haven't been able to do, I just recently started doing more CE again, and I love it, and I hadn't done it for probably a year. I went to IVEX in 2018, and I probably hadn't done any CE until a couple months ago. I was just too burnt out. Like, I just was so unhappy in my job that I just, the thought of learning more when I got home, when I'm learning all day long at work, because when you work emerged, you're constantly researching, I didn't have the emotional energy to do that.
The one key, though, is you want to do the CE, but you also want to make sure that your life at home is not just CE and work.
Yes.
You do need to make boundaries, like set a limit. An hour every 2-3 days or something like that, or like on your weekend, set 2 or 3 hours aside or something like that.
Yeah.
It can't be something that you focus on all the time, because I think that will also leave you to burn out, because mm-hmm. your life revolves around vet and vet only.
That's my problem right now.
And then
now.
Our partners will kill us even.
Yes. Eric is constantly telling me, you need something that isn't vet related, and I'm brutal. I'm still not doing it, because if I'm not doing my work that I'm now doing CE, and if I'm not doing that, I'm working on Kick-Ass Vets, which is just more of that stuff, but it is, right now, that's a really cathartic thing for me, but still, I need to do something that isn't vet related.
I need hobbies.
I'm very, very bad at that.
I think this is a thing as well. You start sacrificing your hobbies when you're getting to the burnout stage.
Mm-hmm.
Not the crash and burn and destroy everything around you stage, but earlier on.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the things you recognize. If you're starting to sacrifice your hobbies, you need to step back and realize things are not going the way they should.
Yeah.
What's the problem here and what can I do about it?
Good point. So, we were doing some research. One of the things that I found online was the 5 stages of burnout. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about during this is, what is compassion fatigue? What is burnout? Just because the words are thrown around a lot. And when we throw them around a lot, we don't really identify what they are. And then you can't say, then it's kind of arbitrary about whether you're feeling it, whether you're not feeling it. Is this normal? Is this not? Because every job is going to have stress. Life is going to have stress. And a certain amount of stress is good for you. A certain amount of stress pushes you to accomplish goals. It makes you productive. It makes you creative. If you had no stress in life, you wouldn't accomplish anything. You know, you have to have a financial stress of putting food on the table to get a job. If mom and dad gave you all the money in the world, look, like, how many examples do we need of people in their lives that squander all of the money on drugs and alcohol and then end up dying?
And you need those stressful cases to push you to learn something new.
Yeah.
Like, if every single case came in and it was just the same old thing, you wouldn't actually go anywhere in your career.
Yeah.
But when you get that weird case that's everything is abnormal and doesn't follow any of the rules, it's stressful because it's probably going to, well, not probably, it could be dying.
Yeah.
But that's the sort of stress that's good, because it pushes you into, like, okay, let's think about this case, let's figure out something.
Yeah.
Let's look into what this means.
And that's one of the things I love about the vet world, is there's variety, there's diversity, and you're constantly learning. That constant learning is stress.
Yeah.
And that's a good level of stress. But the question is, when does that become a bad level of stress? And I found this thing online, and it talks about the 5 stages of burnout, and I'll find it and put a link to it. But it goes through and it talks about the first stage is the honeymoon stage. So you get a new job and everything's lovely. You're excited. You feel productive. You feel creative. You're committed to your job. You're optimistic. And you really have a desire to prove yourself, to show that you're awesome. And, you know, we've all had those feelings in new jobs, and it's great. And, you know, you want that honeymoon stage to last forever. It's never going to last forever. You're always going to get to a point in some job where you're not going to feel that elation every single day. But for the most part, we want our jobs to be that way. You still have a bit of stress. You still have deadlines. You still have hard cases. But you feel motivated. You feel productive. Then you get stage 2, which is the onset of stress. So that's when you start to have the odd days that are bad. You start to become a little bit more irritable. That's a big one for me.
Oh, I've been told it's a big one for me as well. No, it is.
You start to lack focus. You can start to have some physical things like elevated blood pressure, arrhythmias, fatigue, heart palpitations, headaches, GI issues, depending on who you are. Your sleep quality decreases. You start to decrease your social interactions outside of work. And what I think is a big one in the vet world or medical world is you start to avoid decisions. And I see this a lot in vets that are burnt out, is they start second guessing themselves on all of the little things. And I realize I do it too. And as I was reading through, I was like, oh man, I do that when I'm burnt out. It'll be something so simple. It'll be like, you know, I can't even think of an example right now. Like, they're not even trusting yourself to read a blood panel and be like, that's azotemia, right? Like,
I find myself asking a lot more to someone else, like, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
And normally I wouldn't like second guess myself in the slightest with some of these things, but I don't know.
Yeah.
This creeps on before you know it, but you don't recognize it.
No, and that to me, it's like such a thing that you don't even think about. You're like, yeah, I'm just asking someone else. But when you should know something and you're confident and you do know it, not that there's anything wrong with asking a colleague, but if you're constantly asking and you feel that need, that's an early sign of stress.
And then you become more insecure because you do realize you're constantly asking, and then you do it more.
Yeah. And that's the point where you have to start intervening. When you start to realize you're having those bad days, the minute you start feeling physical manifestations. The minute your sleep starts to go, the minute you start to realize that you're losing that confidence, that's the point that we have to start intervening, which is quite early, because I think most people wait until way later to start intervening.
Yeah. Oh.
The third stage is chronic stress, where you have frequent bad days, you lose your hobbies, as we chatted about, you start missing deadlines or arriving late to work because you can't get yourself there, you start to be resentful of either your colleagues or your workspace or people in your personal life for whatever reason, you start to show anger or aggressive behavior or have behavioral changes, you start to become cynical, you can decrease your sex drive, you lose your empathy, you deny that you have problems. So at this point, you start to turn the corner of not being able to see yourself. And that's when you have those changes. You can feel panicked or threatened. You can feel pressured or out of control, increased drug and alcohol use, exhaustion, and more likely to become sick. Then you hit stage four, which is burnout. And when you hit that burnout stage, you really need external help at that point, because you've already turned that corner of denial. And to me, that's so eye-opening, because as I was reading through, I was like, man, I'm definitely past stage three. Maybe I should get some help. So stage four is when you're feeling empty inside. You obsess over problems at work, which is a huge one for me. You start to get a pessimistic outlook. Your physical signs increase, self-doubt, self-isolation. And you just want to drop out of society. You just want to disappear. And then stage five is when you get clinical depression, chronic sadness, chronic physical issues, and that kind of leads to the suicidal thoughts. And just, I'll put a link to this, but to me, seeing those steps and recognizing where you are is very helpful, because some people might think, this is normal. I'm in a tough job. It's normal to feel this way. Everybody feels stressed out. Everybody feels burnt out. There's good stress and there's bad stress, and recognizing where that becomes bad from good, I think, is important. How do you feel about this list?
Well, I was in stage five. I'm not anymore, thank God. I think, it makes sense, the list. The problem is with lists and things like that is that they're quite abstract concepts when you're going through it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't just sit back. So what stage am I today? 1, 2, 3, or 4, or 5? Stage five, you realize you're there when you hit the rock bottom and things go really bad. Stage 3 and 4, you have a chance to recognize that you need to be very self-conscious of what you're going through.
Yeah.
You need to be a person that's probably working on their mental health, and you need to listen to the people around you and ask them for help.
Which we're so good at as vets, asking for help.
Exactly. I think if you're completely oblivious to your mental health, you're not asking people around you, you're not reading their body language and how they're reacting with you, it's very hard to know whether you're on stage four. So you were saying earlier, weren't you, that your partner was pretty much saying that you need to work on yourself?
Yep.
Did you know that before he told you?
I know I'm crazy. I've always been crazy. But in terms of, I had no idea how much what I was doing was affecting him. And as a bystander of what it was affecting me. And I don't even know if I've fully recognized how much it's affecting me yet. You know, it's, even though I'm trying to actively think, I'm such a person of, like, I think I'm in that denial phase.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely, like, he's definitely been hit as a bystander from my job. And there have been times where he's just like, I just want you to quit. I don't want you to be a vet. I wish that the vet profession had never entered your life. Like, it's really hard. And I think being a partner of a vet is a very challenging role, especially when you're the type of person that obsesses or is very vocal. Like, some people just shut down and are quiet in themselves. That's not me. So unfortunately, it is very dangerous. I have a really good friend and colleague who was a classmate of mine, and he was like valedictorian, phenomenal, amazing person. And you would never know in a million years that he was suffering. And he's just done, I'll put a link to it as well, he's just done an interview about his mental health, and he was having suicidal thoughts and like was hitting a breaking point. And this is just like, you know, like the epitome of amazing person that you just never think. And it's because he would internalize it, and he was everything for everyone else. And it's scary.
And that's the key as well, is that the people that seem less likely to have a problem half the time are the people that have the biggest problem, and we can't ignore that. Like, I'll be honest, like, in the last 12 months, unfortunately, I've known two nurses that have committed suicide, and both times you wouldn't guess they were the people to do it.
That's
and
crazy.
It's terrible because you think, Jesus, I should have recognised that they weren't in the right place.
Yeah.
But these people are internalising it, and it's very hard to know what they're going through.
And there was just recently another vet here committed suicide. It's unbelievable. The suicide rates in the vet world are just... like, it's
criminal.
so upsetting. And it happens for so many different reasons. One of the other things is, in terms of burnout and depression, we were going through the list, and it was risk factors for burnout and depression. And it's one of the big things is if you strongly identify with work. So many vets grow up being, I want to be a veterinarian. They have such a strong identity with that profession that it's hard for them to separate that. And I think that that's one of the things that my friend Scott was saying, that like when he went through school, okay, I'm supposed to graduate, then I'm supposed to, like, you know, get married, have the house, have the kids. Now that I'm there, who am I?
That's
and when
thing,
you
like,
lose that sense, like, it's scary.
If you meet someone new and they say to you, tell me about yourself, tell me something about yourself, what would you say?
Well, I would start with, I'm a vet.
Yeah, exactly. First thing, you haven't even said your name yet.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't.
You said I'm a vet.
Yeah.
I don't know many other professions that would do that. Like, I've got loads of friends in accounting and stuff, and they never really describe themselves as an accountant or anything like that.
It's true, and we need to be able to separate ourselves from the profession, because it's a huge risk factor. High workload, including lots of overtime. There's so much, like, huge crisis with filling positions, so everyone's understaffed. Trying to be everything to everyone, so superhero syndrome, like, vets are predisposed to that insanely, being in the health profession, and then feeling that you don't have any control, which I think is another huge, huge part of the vet world, is that, especially as an associate, you don't have control over the medicine you're performing, you don't have control over your schedule sometimes, your workplace, your work environment, like, there's so many things.
And a side note to that, I think a lot of people go into locuming, including myself, because they wanted to gain more control over their life, which is true, and you do, like, you dictate your schedule, your pay, to be honest, even the medicine you practice, because you're going to go walk into a clinic for two or three shifts, they're not going to bother telling you not to do it this way because it's just too much effort. Which is great. The only thing is that you lose control very easily as a locum as well. You don't know when your next job is coming. Even though there's enough work out there to go around 10 times. So you book yourself out solid. You work 6 days in a row, you double shift. It's like, I don't know when my next shift is going to be, so I need to make all the money now. And then before you know it,
that was
gone.
It's when you're the type of person that needs financial stability. I had a huge... Eric and I had many discussions, and it was a big hurdle for me to go from having full-time employment to locuming for that very reason. And it was with the caveat of, you have to be okay with our financial situation. And what helped me in that sense was, I just broke it down to, what is the minimal amount of money that I need to make for life? Like, to pay rent, to pay bills, and to get food on the table. And then anything beyond that is bonus. And so I was like, okay, well, if I only need to work, like, 8 shifts a month on average, well, in the past 2 days, I've been offered 20 shifts. So, and I can always get a full-time job if I need to. So knowing that was helpful. But it's true. We do. We overwork ourselves because, especially, like, with COVID, it's like, well, what's going to happen? So many people lose shifts, you get cut shifts, then you're like, oh, well, I should take this. And then you have control over your schedule, except if you are worried about getting the money, then you're working days, you're working nights, it's all over the place.
And that's the thing, we went from being the commodity in demand. COVID comes along. I, for one, I'm not sure about you, lost all my shifts overnight for about 3 months, which that was one of the catalysts point for me hitting the floor. I got a lot of work back in the end because a lot of it was knee-jerk reaction from clinics. But then you end up, like, scramming your face like a kid in the sweet store because you're like, I've lost all my work. I need to get everything.
Yeah.
Just in case.
I was really fortunate in that I have a kind of more routine gig, and that work was lovely, and they said, like, look, we're going to make sure that you get your hours. So I was super lucky, but my other job where I worked, yeah, they hired someone else and cut my shifts, which is fine. You know, that's part of it. That's why you charge more, and because I'm a little bit crazy in terms of finances, I always make sure I have, like, a three-month safety net.
Yeah.
I had that going in, so that's helpful. But I know a lot of, like, Sarah that I interviewed previously, she's a vet in the UK. She lost all of her shifts, and she hasn't worked in months.
Yeah.
She literally has no work, and the locums there just have no work because they're being hit way harder with COVID. And I think at home, like in North America as well, it's much worse. So I think we're luckier in Australia. A lot of the clinics have stayed open.
We are, but our stress, I'd say, is quite different from what I've been reading and talking to a couple of friends in the States. Their clinics are struggling, but here, I know one clinic I work at, they say they've been up 150% in cases on last year. That's not normal growth.
No.
That's people adopting new puppies, people being at home,
seeing many new puppies.
Yeah, seeing the chronic disease subtleties. But the thing is, they've halved the staff.
Yeah.
You're doing 150% more workload with half the staff. You're doing more overtime.
And so then
you're
the contactless,
seeing more cases per hour.
The poor nurses are, like, running off their feet for the contactless. It's so much more work for them. So it is. It's hard for the clinics. I feel bad for the managers of the clinics. I do, because it's a really hard thing to juggle. But it's been very stressful. And then never knowing, like, are we going back to a normal schedule? Are we not? It's for people that like certainty in their lives. It's very uncertain, which is crazy. Another thing that I have written down here are causes of burnout along with the predisposing factors. So a lack of control of your schedule, workload, assignments, or medicine that we were chatting about. Lack of resources to perform your job, so time, energy, staff, money, unclear job expectations, a dysfunctional workplace dynamics, extremes of activity. So if you're either crazy busy all the time or if it's like completely dead all the time, you're losing your mind. Lack of support, which is huge from managers to staff in the vet industry. Like, they just kind of throw vets under the bus all the time. And work-life balance. So I just feel like vets are, by nature of who becomes a vet and by the nature of the dynamic of the workplace, we're just this, like, we're already halfway up the mountain to burnout before we even start the job.
Yeah. Like, you've got everyone relying on you to do the best job all the time.
Yeah.
And then you get guilt tripping as well on top of that sometimes.
It doesn't
help.
Yeah. Anyway. It's definitely a challenge, but I think identifying the early signs, and then if you start experiencing those early signs, trying to get help earlier and, you know, going to your GP, doing that test, talking to a psychiatrist, like, I think it's something that we all should be jumping to probably a little more readily, and then really trying to define where your problem is instead of just kind of, we just kind of throw out terms and it doesn't, I don't think it's helpful. You know, it's like everybody calling wolf.
Yeah.
And trying to pinpoint down exactly what you're feeling and where it is, I don't know, I think it's something that would be helpful.
Yeah, and also realizing that you're not actually alone.
Mm-hmm.
So when my worst period, I was like, I have no, not that I have no friends, I do have friends, but like, a lot of people which I went to uni with have left Sydney since we finished vet school.
Yeah.
I'm from abroad, I'm from the UK, so a lot of my friends are back there. Yeah, I know, right? Who'd have guessed? You never know. And you start thinking, well, there's no one for me to talk to, like, I don't want to burden my partner with this, I'll just keep it to myself, I'm alone with my problems.
Yeah.
You're not.
Yeah.
You may be physically alone in the room by yourself, but those people are actually only a phone call away or a Skype call away or even sometimes a street or two away, but you just need, to a certain degree, the courage to face up to the problem and say, look, I need some help.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how many people are actually there for you.
Yeah.
Like, so many people turned around and helped me in the last few months. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's really sort of like rejigged everything in my head.
Yeah. It's good.
They're essential. They point things out that you need to see.
Mm-hmm. And then you set up that mentoring through that positivity.
Yeah.
Which I think is so cool that people can go on and be like, I want to be a mentor. I want to be a mentee. And so if you're like feeling stuck or feeling alone, you can just go on there and be like, please help.
That's the thing. And what people need to realize is mentorship is not just how career progression mentorship.
Yeah.
Universally, they give you mentors and stuff, but it's like, oh, how to mentor you for an internship so you know how to then get onto your residency, or how to become a great GP or mixed vet. In reality, mentors also are there for mental health issues. Because they've probably been through the same problem before.
Yeah.
They've suffered the damages and they know how to avoid it, or know the solutions, or know something that may help you.
Yeah.
And you just need to be able to say to them, I need help with this problem.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be embarrassed about at the end of the day. And that's what I struggled to get my head around. I wanted to be the tough guy that was reliable, that wasn't going to cripple under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first one to crash.
What I've recently discovered is, especially starting Kick-Ass Vets, where the platform is trying to get people to be happy in the vet degree. And I do, like, I love the profession. I love being a vet. But that doesn't mean that I don't get burnt out.
Exactly.
And acknowledging, and I felt like, especially starting this, I felt like I had to kind of put on this brave face, because if I felt burnt out, then who am I to say that the vet career is good if I'm getting burnt out? But you can love your career. You can love your job to bits. You can love being a vet and still be burnt out. They're not mutually
exclusive.
Thank you. I'm thinking of a Venn diagram.
Exclusive.
You've got, like, you know, overwork, compassion fatigue, all of those things, and then you've got loving your job, and in between, there's burnout. So even if you love your job, even if you're really quite happy, you have a good work environment, you have a good team, you can still recognize that you have burnout and have to address it and not feel bad or guilty about that. And that's something that I've, in the past couple weeks, have kind of come to myself, because like trying to like be like, yes, the vet profession's amazing.
Twitching of the eye.
Right? Like it's hard, and it's trying to put on that brave face. It's trying to be the strong person, and it's not helpful, because then other people look and are like, oh, well, I should be able to cope.
And you want to be a strong, you end up trying to be a strong person at work as well, because you don't want to be seen as the vet that doesn't know the solution to the problem to the nurses or the techs, whatever you should call them. You don't want to be seen as the vet to the client that is concerned, nervous, scared, because why would they ever trust you?
Yeah.
You don't want to be seen as the weak vet from the bosses that may see that as an opportunity to take advantage.
Yeah.
Not saying all bosses are like that, but unfortunately there's a few out there that are.
It's true, and like we do have to put on a confident face to clients. We do. And sometimes you have to, even if you're not 100% sure in your head, you have to put on that face, because you have to be that source of calm. And if you're in a work environment where, you know, the nurses are really unhappy, sometimes you're holding it together for them. And especially in emergency, I have two examples. When I was a new graduate, a month or two out, something stupid, by myself, of course, my boss had left, and this lady comes running in the building, screaming her head off, being like, help, 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 and I run up, and I see this little shih tzu being like, looking around, totally fine. I'm like, why is this lady crazy? And it took me a second, but its eye had prop toast.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it had been like hit by a car or something. She's like, it's Audra's pop toast! I was like, okay, that's fine, it's fine. I'm just gonna take Fluffy. We're gonna get the eye back in, don't worry about it. I'm gonna go give him pain relief, we're gonna get some paperwork, it's all gonna be fine. I'm a month out. I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea how I'm going to put an eye back in. I have no idea if I'm going to have to nucleate it. But you just put on this face. And then I, like, get the dog. We put an IV catheter. They're getting set up. And we had a co-op student that was in high school. So I get everything going. And I'm like, I know we need to get the eye back in fast. So just put in an IV, get some bloods, get it set up for anesthesia, because we're going to have to do an anesthetic on the dog. And then I start Googling how to put an eye back in.
We've all done it.
Literally. And the co-op student is like, are you Googling what you're about to do? I was like, yeah, I have no idea what I'm doing. She's like, what are you talking about? She's like, but you just said, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. But it went back in. It was fine. But that was like very early on learning that you have to be that front. And then when I was working Emerge a few years ago, I had, like, insane hour, you know, when just everything comes at once. Like, literally in the middle of doing CPR, I have a seizing, snail bait toxicity, like, on the other table that I'm managing. Then another seizing animal comes in. So I'm, like, literally doing CPR, directing the CPR, also directing the nurse how to treat this animal whose temperature is, like, 42 degrees, also directing the other nurse. And
I suppose just, you like, had enough nurses, but honestly.
It was a really good clinic. It was a really nice, and those nurses were, like, phenomenal. When I say directing, I more mean, like, they were like, would you like me to put an IV catheter and get diazepam at 1 mL per kilo for this time? I was like, yes, that's not 1 mL per kilo, that's the wrong dose. But after, the student came up to me, and he was just like, how were you so calm when all of that was happening? And I was like, I was calm on the outside. I wasn't calm on the inside. On the inside, I was like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. But you have to display that outward sense of calm, because if you freak out, then your nurses are going to freak out. Then the owners are going to freak out. And it is, it's a huge burden, and it's a huge thing where, you know, luckily in those two periods of time, I wasn't feeling burnt out. I wasn't, you know, having any of those issues, but in the past, like a year ago, when I was probably stage 4 to 5, there's no way I would have been able to hold this together. Like, there's no way. And so when you're at that point, you can't put yourself in that calm persona. And I don't even know.
Start cracking.
Yeah. And you can't handle and do the jobs that you have to do. And it's, I think the expectation that we can just remain calm all the time and have that exposure, it's a huge burden a lot of the times.
Yeah, especially when you're doing it day after day or several times a day.
Yeah.
It's not just once in a blue moon half the time.
Yeah, like when you have an amazing team, it's a lot easier because it's only once in a while, but when you're working with an inexperienced team or you're in a clinic that's, you know, severely understaffed, which happens a lot of the times, it's just like over and over and over again. But yeah, it's a tough job, but I think, you know, you've given us really good points and things that people can do if they're feeling that way. Like, even just verbally saying out loud, stop that thought. I'm going to do that.
Just talking about it, quite honestly, helps.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, I think, half the problem. People are embarrassed about being depressed or about being burnt out and things like that, and they just don't talk about it. But talking about it, because I don't know, it disassociates you from the problem and makes you sort of like realize how bad things are sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the psychologists are really good. It's like they make you watch this movie of your life.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, but to a lesser degree, when you're talking to a friend, sometimes you realize, ah, well, of course, that's not good. So it's time to do something about it.
In terms of, we were talking earlier before we started recording, we were talking about things that are particularly stressful and should we try to limit that. So we were talking in particular about euthanasias, and when you have a shift where you've like seen a bunch of euthanasias in a row and how that becomes very distressing, and at what point do you just say, no, I can't do this anymore? And there's that fine line of like being available for your clients versus protecting your own mental health. How do you...
I don't know the answer really to the question. Like, I think it's probably very dependent on where you work. If you have a clinic with 10 vets, you can share the load of euthanasia between the 10, but that would probably help.
Yeah.
I don't know, we talked about this earlier. It's like, what do you do with the only vet on and you're like euthanasia number 5 a day? Do you just say we can't see you and send it to another clinic?
Yeah.
Because it's like you're doing a disservice by the pet and the owner, but at the same time, we have to do this career for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Like, how much can we take?
Like, I know
about crippling our career at the end of the day, or is this saying I've had enough of this job and going but doing something completely different?
Like, there are some vets that don't do euthanasia at all. Like, they refuse. They just don't do them. Like, they obviously can't work sole charge.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's, you don't want to get to that point if you can avoid it, because euthanasia is a very important part of our job, and it's a luxury animals have that we don't as humans. Well, most countries, and there's some Swiss people listening. But I don't think it's something we should shy away from.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you do also have to look after yourself and make sure that you're not taking the whole brunt every single day, because you won't last in the career. And if you don't last in the career, then more animals are going to suffer as a result.
Another big part of being burnt out or whatever, that whole thing is taking time off, taking time away from work.
This is important for the American listeners.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. What about, you've got these people graduating with $300,000 worth of debt. They're working a job and a half to try to pay off their debt in 15, 20 years. There's a really good Facebook group called Debt Free Forever for veterinarians, and they give a lot of like financial help. And I'm on there, but fortunately I went to school in Canada and my debt load was like this big compared to theirs. And just the things that they're going through to try to pay for work. Like when I'm burnt out, I have the luxury of taking a week off.
Yeah.
They can't afford to.
I've seen posts where they are like getting relatively well paid as veterinarians go, but only am able to pay off the interest component, not the principal, which is concerning. Obviously, we can't change that ourselves, but
what do you do? And I don't know if there's an answer, but like, what do you do when just financially you need the money, you can't afford to take time off? And you know, if you are getting, like in the States, some of them are getting really good salaries, so to work a different job, they'd have to work twice the number of hours.
Like, the concern I have with the States is as well is that we're very lucky here. You automatically get, 3-4 weeks annual leave.
Yeah.
Then you get, like, obviously the sick leave on top of that, so you don't have to use the annual leave. But, like, my wife, she's American. They used to get 8 or 10 days off per year, but she then had to find someone to cover her when she wanted to go away. You couldn't just take time off. So who does take time off at that point?
Yeah.
And you're not able to get away from it.
I don't know what they're supposed to do.
It's obviously person dependent, like if they have a partner that can support them or not, but at the same time you need to think of short term versus long term, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to destroy yourself in the short term, you're not going to be able to pay off that loan in the long term.
Yeah.
So short term sacrifice may be beneficial, but it's easy for me to say coming from countries which have a government that pays for your education. So.
I know. I feel so bad for them because I just know, like, I have lots of vacation. We go on, you know, lots of trips. Like, my life is not difficult. This is where I live. Like, and I get burnt out. And then I see these stories about these people working a job and a half to make ends meet just so that they can put $7,000-$10,000 a month to their student loans. And I just think, like, who am I to feel burnt out?
Yeah.
And that's the other thing too. I think it's that concept of having that you're comparing yourself to other people, and everybody's path is different. So just because you feel that you shouldn't be cracking under that pressure doesn't mean that you shouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's, I feel really bad.
If you have the luxury of being able to take time off because you don't have to pay student loans off, it's not something to be proud of, saying, I don't ever take time off.
Yeah.
I don't need to take time off. Because at the end of the day, you're actually doing yourself a disservice. Mm-hmm. You're burning out, whether you know it or not. You're actually making the clinic richer at your own cost by not taking time off.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be benefiting necessarily from that.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're the person not taking time off, you're going to get the pay rise, per se.
Yeah, that's true.
And just remember that. Don't feel guilty you're taking time off. You need to do it for yourself.
Yeah, that's crazy. All right, well, do you have any other suggestions, you know, general advice related to mental health or not for our lovely people that have stuck with us for as long as they have?
Yeah, I think you should also consider what you're doing. This is the compassion fatigue thing.
Oh, yeah.
If you see an animal come in and you don't care whether it lives or not, or if it's actually easier for you if it dies, because it means less workload, that's the day you should start taking time off and talking to someone.
Yeah.
And that does happen.
And
to
I think
people.
It's
not just, it's happened to me sometimes. I'm like, Jesus Christ, why can't I just fuck off?
Yeah.
Like, I don't have time for this.
I think a lot of people don't want to admit that they feel that. When a difficult case comes in, a hit by car with multiple traumas, and you know that if the owners have money in pursuit to treat this, your next 10 hours are every moment by that dog. And part of your mind says, I hope they just euthanize. because that would be easier. And it's like, just saying that out loud makes me feel shameful, but I would be lying if I haven't felt that way. And it's,
yeah,
it's,
I was working with a vet the other day. He's the dog died, and he said, well, at least that's a shorter write-up.
Yeah.
Move on.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not sure if he's just been sarcastic. It's dark humor.
And I think people use humor as a defense mechanism, right?
But
and, you know, but it's
what's underlying the humor, though.
Yeah, and it's true. Having that, when you lose the empathy, that's a huge, huge flag of you're down the path of burnout. So you need to address that. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that I'm really excited for your vet positivity and what's going to come from that. I think it's great that's available.
Interesting, that's for sure. It wasn't where I thought it was going to go. So
yeah, no, it's such a great resource. So I think it's really great that's available. And I'll put links to the things that we chatted about, the mindfulness stuff and those questions in the blog section. But if you have any questions or you need help or you feel on the edge, like Joe said, you're never alone. There's so many people that are there to help you, that want to help, that have been through it. Nothing that you are feeling or experiencing is new.
No.
And chances are the 10 vets that you know around you are experiencing those things as well. So just try to open up and talk about it and don't feel bad. Don't feel shameful. Don't feel like you're not worthy.
take pride in fixing yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Focus on, I'm going to make myself better, I'm going to address this and move on, because we don't want to see you, the next person that's circulating, that you've committed suicide. Like, I can't say enough. Nobody wants that. Nobody thinks that the world would be better off without you. Nobody thinks that you are not worth it. And everybody is there to help you. So just try to reach out.
Yeah, I agree completely.
All right, thanks so much, and we will see you next time.